Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Hello, you are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. New Battleground, Politics Inflame School Boards, by Julie Carr Smith and Patty Nyberg, The Associated Press, byline, Columbus, Ohio. In a school district near the state capitol, school board members up for re-election this year have been subjected to a steady stream of lawsuits and attacks, both in person and online. In another, an incumbent up for re-election who supports student mask requirements received a letter from someone angered by her stance who warned, "We are coming after you." A 15-year veterans board member in another Ohio district decided against running for re-election because of the escalating public attacks. It's not just in Ohio. Across the U.S., local school board races have emerged as an intense political battleground in the November 2nd elections, with much at stake for students. Parental protests over COVID-19-related mask mandates, gender-neutral bathrooms, and teachings about racial history, sexuality, and social-emotional learnings are being leveraged into full-fledged board takeover campaigns that will get their first widespread tests in just a few weeks. What's happening in 2021 is a prelude to some of the messaging, some of the issues we'll be seeing going into the midterm elections, said Scott DeMauro, president of the Ohio Education Association, the state's largest teachers union. Local school board elections typically have been relatively quiet affairs in which incumbents sail to re-election, often unopposed. This year, candidate training academies organized by national conservative groups and state-level recruitment efforts are encouraging challenges by right-leaning political newcomers. The results could have a consequence for public education and coronavirus safety measures across the country. The thousands of local school districts in the U.S. make it difficult to know how many sitting board members are facing challenges next month from conservative-leaning community members, but the challenges appear widespread. In Wisconsin, a conservative legal institute is providing free legal advice on school board recalls to parent groups. In Iowa, Governor Kim Reynolds, a Republican, has taken the unusual step of endorsing a conservative candidate for a local school board seat. And in Colorado, a group calling itself MAD that opposes remote learning and what it says are partisan leanings in curriculum is endorsing like-minded school board candidates. It feels like schools have become a political battleground, and they shouldn't be, said Dan Malo, a former Green Beret who runs the Colorado group. Kids should be able to walk in and not know what their teachers believe politically or their administrators and be protected from what society is arguing about so they can focus on learning to read and write, understanding math, learning an unbiased history. Teachers' unions, which for years have helped elect their own allies to school boards, are opposing the push. Their position is that many right-wing candidates are conspiracy theorists who are taking moderate positions to get elected, but once in office, will oppose mask requirements and other COVID-19 safety protocols, micromanage educators, and censor classroom content they dislike. Randy Weingarten, president of the National Federation of Teachers, called it a craven and anti-democratic attempt to usurp local control over our kids' education. FreedomWorks, a conservative group that supported the rise of former President Donald Trump, launched a candidate academy in March that has trained about 300 people nationwide, with the largest number from Ohio, said Laura Zork, the group's director of education reform. About 1,000 people have signed up, she said. My message to these parents is run for office if you don't like it and you don't feel your voice is being heard, Zork said. Among those who acted on that message is Jennifer Fuchst, a candidate in the Olentangy local school district outside Columbus, who completed training through FreedomWorks Academy. After fighting to lift mask mandates and to get the district to declare its opposition to critical race theory, the mother of three said she has been the victim of vicious attacks on social media. I've learned that they're allowed to say things that are untrue because you're a public figure. I never imagined that at the local level, she said. An especially common claim among the challengers is that schools are teaching black children that they're victims and white children they're villains, which they attribute to critical race theory. It's a characterization of districts' responses to last year's racial protests that national education and civil rights organizations have rejected as false and dangerous. Critical race theory is a way of thinking about America's history through the lens of racism that was developed in the 1970s and 1980s. There is little evidence it is taught in schools. One of the active groups in Ohio is Ohio Value Voters, which created its own spinoff, Protect Ohio Children Coalition, in April, state business records show. The group's leaders did not return phone calls or emails seeking comment, but its website coaches parents to show up in groups of 30 and employ a tsunami strategy to raise hot-button social issues and disrupt board meetings. The group also keeps an interactive indoctrination map that takes aim at districts offering what it describes as critical race theory, comprehensive sexuality education, and social-emotional learning. It states, as one of its goals, replacing radical school board officials through the election process. As a taste of what incumbents are facing, Nikki Hudson, a school board member in Worthington, another Columbus suburb, who is up for re-election, received a letter that threatened, "We are coming after you," it added. "You are forcing them to wear a mask for no reason in this world other than control, and for that you will pay dearly." The letter was referred to the U.S. Justice Department. It's really demoralizing and sad that we've lost that focus on what we really should be about, which is the students, said Amy Baca Olert, president of the Colorado Education Association, the state's largest teachers union. It really seems that adult issues have monopolized the conversations versus thinking about the needs of our students. Schools wary of teacher assaults and pranks egged on by social media. By Tai Tagami, the New York Times Company, Byline, Atlanta. Schools dealing with reacclimating students to classrooms this fall are facing a new challenge, social media posts daring them to destroy school property and even hit teachers. In August, Fulton County Schools held 60 tribunals for students in connection with serious offenses, such as bringing drugs or weapons to school. Then came the internet-driven pranks. Superintendent Mike Looney told his school board last week that he increased security after a social media platform hosted calls for vandalism and assault in schools starting last month. Posts by users of TikTok, a platform for short and sometimes humorous video clips, have included various challenges over the years, from full facial waxing to licking toilets. As school resumed this fall, students became the target actors, starting with September's Devious Lick Challenge, encouraging theft from bathrooms. This TikTok nonsense that's creating havoc in schools across the country has to stop, Looney said, adding that parents must reimburse the district for any damages their children cause. In Gwinnett County, Georgia's largest school district, several students face criminal charges in connection with the bathroom challenge, Superintendent Calvin Watts told parents Monday. In October, a new social media challenge has emerged, calling for students to slap a teacher on the backside, Watts wrote, adding that any such acts would be treated as sexual assault. He exhorted parents to talk with their children. Cherokee County had to discipline students after bathroom soap, toilet paper dispensers, ceiling tiles, and teachers' classroom supplies were stolen, according to a spokeswoman, with two cases producing misdemeanor juvenile charges of criminal trespass. In neighboring Forsyth County schools, families were charged up to $500 restitution after students acted on TikTok challenges at the majority of the middle and high schools, spokeswoman Jennifer Caracciolo said by email. They were caught on cameras, in the hallways, outside restrooms, and through anonymous reports by other students on a campus app. The maximum school punishment is long-term suspension, with criminal charges possible, she said. Beverly Rice, who teaches at Maynard Holbrook Jackson High School in Atlanta, worries about the potential for escalation with the October challenge to slap a teacher. Of course, all of the teachers are talking about it, Rice said. Some teachers at her school have said they would react violently if students follow through on the challenge. So in essence, in jest, they're just basically saying they feel like if a kid assaults them, that they're going to retaliate, she said. But you know that's just talk. Still, Rice has noticed more administrators in the hallways and said that makes her and other teachers feel safer. Everyone is on high alert. In Coweta County, two students at Evans Middle School were charged with crimes, theft for one and criminal trespass for the other, after soap dispensers were removed from walls and toilets were filled with paper towels, Channel 2 Action News reported last month. China-based TikTok said in that report that it is removing content that promotes or enables criminal activity. U.S. law does not treat internet service providers as the publishers or speaker of the content they host, so they are not civilly liable for it, said Thomas Kadri, an assistant professor of law at the University of Georgia. Aside from the civil liability prong, there's no criminal law that I know of that would make TikTok's decision to kind of host this content illegal. And if there were such a criminal law, it would certainly face First Amendment challenges, Kadri said. In other words, schools and parents must live with the situation. Caracciolo, the Forsyth spokeswoman, said parents and guardians should familiarize themselves with the various TikTok challenges and discuss the consequences with children. Upcoming challenges involve assault, causing bodily harm, and public indecency nudity, she noted. Rice, the Atlanta teacher, said social media is merely stoking an existing problem. She estimated that one or two teachers have been assaulted by students at her school each year. In addition to COVID and catching COVID and kids coming to school sick every day and all of the other things we have to worry about, it's very unsettling to say the least, she said. When Child Care Costs More Than the Mortgage by Jason de la Parle, the New York Times Company, Greensboro, North Carolina. To understand the problems Democrats hope to solve with their supersized plan to make child care better and more affordable, consider the small southern city of Greensboro, where many parents spend more for care than they do for mortgages, yet teachers get paid like fast food workers and centers cannot hire enough workers. With its white pillars and soaring steeple, the Friendly Avenue Baptist Church evokes an illusory past. When fathers left for work, mothers stayed home to mother, and education began when children turned five. But its sought-after preschool illuminates the dilemmas of modern family life. Until their elder son started kindergarten this fall, Jessica and Matt Lolly paid almost $2,000 a month for their two boys' care, about one-third of their income, and far more than their payments on their three-bedroom house. But one of the teachers who watched the boys earns so little, $10 an hour, that she spends half her time working at Starbucks, where the pay is 50% higher and includes health insurance. The center's director wants to raise wages but has little room to pass along costs to parents who are stretched. She's been trying since February to replace a teacher who quit without warning. Four applicants accepted the job in turn, but none showed up. I've been an administrator for 30 years, and I've never seen anything like this, said the director, Sandy Johnson. Directors are at the point where they're willing to hire anyone who walks through the door. The children deserve far more than that, and the families deserve far more than that. Democrats describe the problem as a fundamental market failure. It simply costs more to provide care than many families can afford, and are pushing an unusually ambitious plan to bridge the gap with federal subsidies. The huge social policy bill being pushed by President Joe Biden would cap families' child care expenses at 7% of their income, offer large subsidies to child care centers, and require the centers to raise wages in hopes of improving teacher quality. A version before the House would cost $250 billion over a decade and raise annual spending fivefold or more within a few years. An additional $200 billion would provide universal pre-kindergarten. This would be the biggest investment in the history of childcare, said Stephanie Schmidt, an analyst at the Center for Law and Social Policy, a research group that supports the measure. For too long, parents have had to struggle with the high cost of care, while child care providers have been incredibly undervalued and underpaid. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to do right for everyone. Prospects remain uncertain for the broader bill, which includes new educational, health care, and child-rearing subsidies. Some Democrats balked at Biden's request for $3.5 trillion over 10 years and proposed a figure closer to $2 trillion. Republicans strongly oppose the safety net expansion, saying that it is unaffordable and smacks of socialism. And some conservatives warn the child care provisions would inflate costs, impose burdensome regulations, and penalize parents who prefer informal care. As Democrats describe it, child care is an issue not just of family finance, but of macroeconomics. Parents need it to join the workforce. Brain development, much of which happens before children start school. And racial equity. The low-paid workforce is disproportionately composed of minorities. In Greensboro, parents know little about the Democrats' plan, but much about child care costs, which can cause them to reconfigure work hours, postpone the purchase of cars and appliances, or have fewer children than they desire. We had no idea child care was going to cost this much, said Jessica Lally, who works in human resources for the public school system and whose husband sells plumbing fixtures at Lowe's. There's no way we could afford to have another child. Greensboro has been a hub of child care advocacy since at least the early 1990s, when local organizers helped lead a national campaign called Worthy Wages, which sought to raise pay and improve working conditions. The state government is also known as a leader. It offers scholarships to child care workers who want more education and runs two wage subsidy programs, which together reach about 1 in 8 child care workers and provide average bonuses of about $2,400 a year. Although center directors say they cannot hire, teachers say they cannot pay their bills. Earning $10 an hour at the Little Leaders Learning Academy, Uvika Joseph, a single mother, got food stamps and Medicaid for her 3 children. She just left to become an assistant in the public schools, where she expects to earn nearly twice as much and will receive health insurance. The only reason I am leaving is the pay, she said. I love the kids. To make ends meet, Rochelle Myers, who has an associate degree in early childhood education, splits a 60-hour workweek between the Friendly Avenue Center and Starbucks. She called the Democrats' plan to raise wages amazing and overdue. I make $10 an hour to shape the future of children, but make $15 an hour to hand someone a cup of coffee, she said. That doesn't make sense. Conservatives fear government intrusion into the family realm. Rachel Gressler, an analyst with the Heritage Foundation, recently warned Congress that the measure would increase costs and drive small centers out of business, especially those based in homes and churches. She also said the policy would penalize parents who stay at home, taxing them to expand center-based care and ignoring the tremendous personal and societal value of full-time child rearing. Lolly said she thought about staying at home after having a second child, but needed the health insurance that came with her job. "Oh my God, it was terrible," she said of the cost, more than $20,000 a year, of having two children in care. She hung on with significant help from her parents, knowing that we wouldn't have a kid in daycare forever. Lolly knew nothing of the plan until a reporter described it, and she reacted with enthusiasm tinged with concern. She praised the potential financial relief and the wonderful help for teachers, whom she called devoted and very underpaid. Washington. McConnell seizes on standoff to undermine Biden agenda. By Lisa Mascaro, The Associated Press. Byline, Washington. In the frantic bid to divert a default on the nation's debt, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell held a position of unusual power as the one who orchestrated both the problem and the solution. McConnell is no longer the majority leader, but he is exerting his minority status in convoluted and uncharted ways, all to stop President Joe Biden's domestic agenda, and even if doing so pushes the country toward grave economic uncertainty. All said, the outcome of this debt crisis leaves zero confidence there won't be a next one. In fact, McConnell engineered an end to the standoff that ensures Congress will be in the same spot in December when funding to pay America's bills next runs out. That means another potentially devastating debt showdown, all as the COVID-19 crisis lingers and the economy struggles to recover. "Mitch McConnell loves chaos," said Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio, chairman of the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. "He's a very smart tactician and strategist, but the country pays the price so often for what he does." The crisis has cemented McConnell's legacy as a master of misdirection. He's the architect of the impasse and the one who resolved it, if only for the short term. More battles are to come as Democrats narrow Biden's big agenda, a now $2 trillion expansion of health, childcare, and climate change programs, all paid for with taxes on corporations and the wealthy, that Republicans oppose. To some Republicans, McConnell is a shrewd leader, using every tool at his disposal to leverage power and undermine Biden's priorities. To others, including Donald Trump, he is weak, having caved too soon. To Democrats, McConnell remains an infuriating rival who has shown again he is willing to break one institutional norm after another to pursue Republican power. McConnell's role is to be the leader of the opposition, and it's his job to push back on what the majority wants to do, said Alex Conant, a Republican strategist. "Nobody should be surprised to see the leader of the Republicans making the Democrats' job harder," he said. Biden, in comments made via video Saturday to the Democratic National Committee's fall meeting, hinted at the damage McConnell could inflict, not just on that agenda, but also on the party's broader case to the electorate. The president urged activists at virtual meetings to keep making the case for government solutions, even as Republicans try to undercut that message. "Just as the Republican Party today offers nothing but fear, lies, and broken promises, we have to keep cutting through the Republican fog that government is the problem and show that we, the people, are always the solution," Biden said. The debt showdown left Democrats who control Washington portrayed as big spenders, willing to boost the nation's $28.4 trillion debt to pay the bills. But both parties have contributed to that load because of past decisions that left the government rarely operating in the black. Republicans risk recriminations from all sides for their deeply divided party. In easing off the crisis, McConnell insulated his Republicans from further blame, but infuriated Trump and his allies, who are eager to skewer the Kentucky senator for giving in. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, said he told his colleagues during a private meeting before the debt vote that it was a mistake for Republican leadership to agree to this deal. "Once a routine vote to ensure the nation's bills are paid, raising the debt limit has become a political weapon, particularly for Republicans, to rail against government spending. The Tea Party class of Republicans a decade ago brought the nation to the brink of default over the issue and set a new GOP strategy. In this case, McConnell made it clear he had no demands other than to disrupt Biden's domestic agenda, the $2 trillion package that is the president's signature legislation, but is derided by Republicans as a socialist tax and spending spree. In muscling Biden's agenda to passage, Democrats are relying on a complicated procedure, the budget reconciliation process, which allows 51 votes for approval, rather than the 60 typically needed to overcome Senate objections. In the 50-50 split Senate, Vice President Kamala Harris gives Democrats the majority with her ability to cast a tie-breaking vote. McConnell seized on the Democratic budget strategy as a way to conflate the issues, announcing months ago he wanted Democrats to increase the debt limit on their own using the same procedure. It was his way of linking Biden's big federal government overhaul with the nation's rising debt load, even though they are separate and most of Biden's agenda hasn't been enacted. The debt-raising vote rarely has been popular, and both parties have had to do it on their own at times. But McConnell struck new legislative ground, trying to dictate the terms to Democrats. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, promptly ignored McConnell's demands for the cumbersome process and set out to pass the debt ceiling bill with a more traditional route. As the October 18th deadline approached, when Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned the government would run out of funds to pay the nation's bills, Schumer's strategy hit the Republican blockade, or filibuster. Only after business pressure mounted and Biden implored Republicans to get out of the way did McConnell call a timeout. McConnell orchestrated the way around the problem by allowing the traditional vote Thursday night, and even joining 10 other Republican senators in helping Democrats reach the 60-vote threshold needed to ease off the crisis. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki lauded the Republicans who did their part tonight, ending the filibuster and allowing Democrats to do the work of raising the debt limit. But she urged the parties to come together to find a more permanent solution. We can't allow the routine process of paying our bills to turn into a confidence-shaking political showdown every 2 years or every 2 months, she said. Schumer struck a more acerbic tone. Republicans played a dangerous and risky partisan game, and I am glad that their brinkmanship did not work, he said. That, too, brought trouble. McConnell said in a letter to Biden late Friday that such antics assure I will not provide such assistance again. That night, before voting, McConnell told Republican colleagues that he devised the solution in part because he was worried that Democrats would change the filibuster rules, as they had been discussing as an option of last resort. He had reached out to two key Democrats, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, to ensure they weren't thinking of doing that. And besides, the Republican leader had accomplished his goal, jamming up Biden's agenda, sowing the seeds of fiscal distress, and portraying Democrats as a party struggling to govern. It's the first big fight that McConnell has picked with Biden, and it appears to be the one that could define the final phase of their decades-long association. COVID-19, Moderna keeps vaccine out of reach of the poor, by Rebecca Robbins, the New York Times Company. Moderna, whose coronavirus vaccine appears to be the world's best defense against COVID-19, has been supplying its shots almost exclusively to wealthy nations, keeping poor countries waiting and earning billions in profit. After developing a breakthrough vaccine with the financial and scientific support of the U.S. government, Moderna has shipped a greater share of its doses to wealthy countries than any other vaccine manufacturer, according to Airfinity, a data firm that tracks vaccine shipments. About 1 million doses of Moderna's vaccine have gone to countries that the World Bank classifies as low income. By contrast, 8.4 million Pfizer doses and about 25 million single-shot Johnson & Johnson doses have gone to those countries. Of the handful of middle-income countries that have reached deals to buy Moderna shots, most have not received any doses, and at least 3 have had to pay more than the United States or European Union did, according to government officials in those countries. Thailand and Colombia are paying a premium. Botswana doses are late. Tunisia could not get in touch with Moderna. Unlike Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca, which have diverse rosters of drugs and other products, Moderna sells only the COVID-19 vaccine. The Massachusetts company's future hinges on the commercial success of its vaccine. They're behaving as if they have absolutely no responsibility beyond maximizing the return on investment, said Dr. Tom Frieden, a former head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Moderna executives have said that they are doing all they can to make as many doses as possible, as quickly as possible, but that their production capacity remains limited. All of the doses they produce this year are filling existing orders from governments such as the EU. Even so, the Biden administration has grown increasingly frustrated with Moderna for not making its vaccine more available to poorer countries, two senior administration officials said. The administration has been pressuring Moderna executives to increase production at U.S. plants and to license the company's technology to overseas manufacturers that can make doses for foreign markets. Moderna is scrambling to defend itself against accusations that it is putting a priority on the rich. On Friday, after the New York Times sent detailed questions about how few poor countries have been given access to Moderna's vaccine, the company announced it was currently investing to increase its output so it could deliver 1 billion doses to low-income countries in 2022. The company also said this past week that it would open a factory in Africa, without specifying when. Moderna executives have been talking with the Biden administration about selling low-cost doses to the federal government, which would donate them to poorer countries, such as Pfizer has agreed to do, the two senior officials said. The negotiations are continuing. In an interview Friday, Moderna CEO Stefan Barnsell said it is sad that his company's vaccine had not reached more people in poorer countries, but that the situation was out of his control. He said Moderna tried and failed last year to get governments to kick in money to expand the company's scant production capacity, and that the company decides how much to charge based on factors including how many doses are ordered and how wealthy a country is. A Moderna spokesperson disputed Airfinity's calculation that the company had provided 900,000 doses to low-income countries, but she did not provide an alternate figure. Nearly a year after Western countries began sprinting to vaccinate their populations, the focus in recent months has shifted to the severe vaccine shortages in many parts of the world. Dozens of poorer countries, mostly in Africa and the Middle East, had vaccinated less than 10% of their populations as of September 30th. In August, for example, Johnson & Johnson faced rebukes from the Director General of the World Health Organization and public health activists after the Times reported that doses of that shot produced in South Africa were being exported to wealthier countries. Biden administration officials are especially frustrated with what they see as Moderna's lack of cooperation because the U.S. government has provided the company with critical assistance. Scientists at the National Institutes of Health worked with the company to develop the vaccine. The United States kicked in $1.3 billion for clinical trials and other research. And in August 2020, the government agreed to order $1.5 billion of the vaccine, guaranteeing that Moderna would have a market for what was an unproven product. Although clinical trials last year found that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines were similarly effective, more recent studies suggest that Moderna's shot is superior. It offers longer-lasting protection and is easier to transport and store. Moderna's shot is essentially the premium vaccine, said Karen Anderson, an industry analyst at Morningstar. They're in a position where they probably don't need to sacrifice too much on pricing in a lot of these deals. Only a handful of governments have disclosed how much they're paying for Moderna doses. The United States paid $15 to $16.50 for each shot, on top of the $1.3 billion the government gave Moderna to develop its vaccine. the EU has paid $22.60 to $25.50 for its Moderna doses. Botswana, Thailand, and Colombia, which the World Bank classifies as upper middle income countries, have said they are paying $27 to $30 per Moderna dose. Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine has been transformative for the company and its leaders. The company has said it expects its vaccine to generate at least $20 billion this year, which would make it one of the most lucrative medical products in history. Anderson, the Morningstar analyst, projected that the company's profits on the vaccine could be as high as $14 billion. In 2019, Moderna reported total revenue of $60 million. Moderna's market value has nearly tripled this year to more than $120 billion. Two of its founders, as well as an early investor, this month made Forbes magazine's list of the 400 richest people in the United States. New river of lava threatens even more buildings on La Palma. Byline, Los Llanos de Aridane, Canary Islands. A new river of lava belched Saturday from the La Palma volcano, spreading more destruction on the Atlantic Ocean island, where more than 1,000 buildings have been engulfed or badly damaged by streams of molten rock. The partial collapse of the volcanic cone overnight gave birth to a new lava stream that started to follow a similar path down the Cumbre Vieja Ridge toward the western shore of the island to the ocean. Authorities said the new lava flow is within the area that was evacuated hastily after the September 19th eruption, when 6,000 residents were forced to flee their homes and farms. Police let residents whose homes could now be in danger make trips to save what they could. Trucks entered the exclusion zone empty Saturday and left with mattresses, furniture, and other belongings. Emergency official Miguel Angel Morcunde said experts closely were watching the delta of new land being formed off the island's coast since the main lava flow reached the sea level last week. A total of 1,186 buildings have been destroyed on La Palma, and 1,228 acres have been covered with lava as of Saturday, according to the European Union's Copernicus Emergency Management Service. The island is part of Spain's Canary Islands, an archipelago off northwest Africa that is a popular vacation destination. This is from the Associated Press. 2020 protests. Few officers will face penalty, by Elise Schmelzer and Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. The internal investigations into how Denver police threatened protesters during last year's racial justice demonstrations are nearly complete, and few officers will be disciplined in connection with the chaotic protests that sparked lawsuits and a scathing report from the city's police watchdog. The Denver Police Department's Internal Affairs Bureau opened 123 cases in connection to the protests that dominated the city's streets in late May and June of 2020, following the murder of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer. Protesters called for an end to racism and the reform or abolishment of policing, and law enforcement officers responded in large numbers to the crowds of thousands. The Denver police response to the protests grew scrutiny after hundreds of protesters and bystanders were struck with police projectiles, engulfed in tear gas, or hit with pepper spray. Of the 123 cases, 108 have been completed. Two officers were suspended for inappropriate use of force. One received an oral reprimand for violating body camera policy, and another received a written reprimand for violating social media policy, according to department data. 59 cases, or nearly half of those completed, were declined, meaning the case was closed during a preliminary review before a full investigation began, data from the Denver Department of Public Safety shows. And almost half of the declined cases, 28 of 59, were closed because investigators could not identify the officer involved. 24 cases were closed because the complainant did not respond to investigators. And others were closed because the officer was exonerated or the alleged behavior did not warrant a full investigation. Cases also were declined because the officer belonged to another department or because body camera footage disproved the allegations. 15 cases remain open, 12 of which are being reviewed by the Independent Monitor or the Conduct Review Office. 3 remain under investigation. Police Chief Paul Pazin, in an interview last week, called the review process thorough and comprehensive, noting that District Attorney Beth McCann has not brought charges against officers in connection with any of the protest-related cases. "We have held people accountable for violations," he said, "and will continue to look for ways to improve as a department." The police chief noted last summer's protests were an extraordinary situation and that the department had handled protests and demonstrations very successfully for many, many years. "This was at a different intensity," Pazin said. One of the people who attended last year's protests, however, expressed dismay at what she perceived as a lack of discipline for the officers who confronted demonstrators on the streets. "I'm definitely disappointed," said Dr. April Alexander, a University of Denver professor who initially joined a class action lawsuit brought by the ACLU in June 2020 after witnessing officers launch tear gas into groups of protesters without warning. She has since withdrawn from the lawsuit. "It's unfortunate we can't hold the system accountable for the misconduct reported in the Independent Monitor report. The lack of repercussions is not surprising," she said, "but it makes it all the more crucial for what she called needed changes coming from SB-217, the sweeping police accountability bill signed into law during summer 2020. The law mandates, among a myriad of other changes, that all uniformed officers in the state wear body cameras and give the Attorney General power to prosecute departments and officers. Katina Banks, a member of Denver's Citizen Oversight Board, said she was surprised that there weren't more complaints from protesters reported to the city. The board first requested the data and will now analyze the numbers and see whether changes in disciplinary policy or procedure are needed. "My sense is that we need to have further discussions with Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin and the Department of Public Safety about these numbers and to understand their implications and what we may need to do differently in the future," she said. The Independent Monitor's Office, which serves as the city's police watchdog, criticized Denver police leaders' lack of documentation in its investigation into the department's response to the protests. Department leaders failed to maintain rosters of which officers were deployed to the protests or where those officers went, according to the December report. Many officers did not complete detailed use of force reports or turn on their body cameras. The Independent Monitor's investigation found the lack of this documentation made accountability difficult or impossible. Pazin promised sweeping changes to the department's handling of future protests after the release of the report. Denver police also have been subject to a series of lawsuits in district and federal court related to officers' actions during the protests. Last month, 50 protesters sued the city, alleging police officers used tear gas, projectiles, and other weapons against them as they demonstrated or observed peacefully. Other lawsuits included individuals alleging they lost some of their sight after police shot them in the eye with projectiles. A 21-year-old delivery driver said last year that he was walking to his car on May 30, 2020, when a law enforcement officer riding on the back of a Denver Police Department truck fired a projectile at his face without warning and blinded him in one eye. "The actions of the Denver Police Department during the George Floyd protests have consequences. This is one of those consequences," attorney Burke Bumgarter, who brought one of the lawsuits, said last month. "You can't violate the Constitution as a police force in a city without repercussions anymore." Pazin is expected to speak at the Citizen Oversight Board's October 15th meeting. The board, which has 2 vacancies, is soliciting questions from the public to ask Pazin. The board can be contacted at 720-913-3150 or cob@denvergov.org. The Citizen Oversight Board is interested in hearing from the community what their thoughts are about these numbers and what questions they have, Banks said. Election 2021. Voters will be asked whether to cap sales tax rate, by Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. Denver voters are willing to raise taxes, made apparent in last year's election when they approved two 0.25% sales tax increases as a means to raise money for climate change issues and support for the unhoused. This year, voters are being asked through initiated Ordinance 304 to permanently cap the combined sales and uses tax rate in Denver at 4.5%, lower than the current 4.81%. The man behind the proposed hard sales tax cap is Garrett Flicker, the chairman of the Denver Republican Party. Local sales taxes are highly regressive, meaning they're much more burdensome for lower earners than for higher earners, Flicker wrote in an email to the Denver Post. Denverites should cap the sales tax at 4.5% to limit the extent to which the city can rely on taxing the poor to fund services. But the measure has opponents from downtown office towers to union halls to the city and county building. Mayor Michael Hancock blasted the measure September 15th when he laid out his proposed $1.4 billion budget for next year. If 304 passes, he said, it would result in an immediate cut of up to $80 million from the 2022 budget, something he is determined to avoid after the pandemic wreaked havoc on city finances. It would inhibit our ability to continue to address the issues that the people have said are important for us to address: housing, affordable housing, homelessness, preschool, climate change, transportation, roads, solid waste, safety, Hancock said. Our quality of life would be impacted. City officials say 52% of all the money in the city's general fund, a pot largely used to pay the city's workforce, including police and firefighters, comes from sales and use taxes. The City Council passed a proclamation opposing the measure this month, saying in part that sales taxes are paid by visitors and residents alike, and that the city has tried to keep low-income residents from being too impacted by sales taxes by exempting food, fuel, medicine, and feminine hygiene products. Flicker pointed to an analysis of Ordinance 304 by the Common Sense Institute, a politically unaffiliated but business-focused think tank, that found Denver's sales tax rate has risen almost 32% since 2018 because of six voter-approved measures. The analysis also found that if the sales tax rate was cut from 4.81% to 4.5% next year, tax collections would fall by $69.2 million, but city revenue in total would fall by only 0.5% and still be well above 2019 levels. The Common Sense Institute noted that individual savings would vary based on spending habits, but it estimated the average Denver household would save $120 a year if 304 passed. But there's another sticking point for opponents. The measure mandates that if voters approve sales tax increases in the future, those must be offset by cuts to keep the aggregate tax rate under 4.5%. If 304 passes, city staff members would have to work immediately with the city council to figure out what to trim in 2021, Department of Finance spokeswoman Julie Smith said. Dedicated sales tax funds, such as the Green Initiatives tax passed last year, would not be immune, she said. Even the city's marijuana sales tax could be affected, given this year's initiated Ordinance 300. The Downtown Denver Partnership is one of the organizations that opposes 304, and President and CEO Tammy Duer calls the ballot measure too restrictive and short-sighted. "This isn't a community that values restrictions on their future decisions," Duer said. "And this is a restriction on future opportunities that we may want to evolve and on future problems that we may want to solve." In news briefs, Denver police investigating vehicle shooting that left man dead. A man was fatally shot while driving in a vehicle Friday night, and authorities are still searching for a suspect, according to Denver police. The shooting occurred at about 9:36 p.m. Friday at East 40th Avenue and Chambers Road, and is not believed to be a road rage incident, Officer Cassandra Ulrich said. The suspect shot from one vehicle into the victim's vehicle, and the man was pronounced dead at the scene. Police are still investigating the shooting, and no other information has been released about a potential motive or suspect. Anyone with information is asked to contact Metro Denver Crime Stoppers at 720-913-7867. Salmonella outbreak tied to seafood from Denver-based company sickens 82 Coloradans. A salmonella outbreak connected to seafood that Denver-based Northeast Seafood Products Incorporated processed or manufactured has made at least 82 Coloradans in 14 counties ill. Of 102 people in 14 states who got sick from salmonella, all but two live in Colorado or reported traveling to the state week before they became ill, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. 19 were hospitalized from the illness, the food safety alert stated. The agency is investigating with the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment and the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA reported samples collected from Northeast Seafood on October 7th were positive for Salmonella Thompson and matched the outbreak strain. Northeast Seafood Products has temporarily stopped production and has recalled haddock, monkfish, bone-in trout, grouper, red snapper, red rock cod, ocean perch, Pacific cod, halibut, coho salmon, Atlantic salmon portions, lane snapper, tilapia, all-natural salmon fillet, Pacific sole, and farm-raised striped bass that restaurants and grocery stores purchased and sold through October 7th, according to the Food Safety Alert. Those stores include Albertsons, Safeway, and Sprouts in Colorado. According to CDPHE, the Pacific cod from Sprouts is not being recalled. The CDC reminds consumers and restaurants to throw out any recalled products, wash any containers and surfaces that touch the food, and throw away any seafood that they're unsure about. Anyone who experiences severe symptoms of salmonella, such as diarrhea, fever, vomiting, dehydration, dry mouth and throat, or dizziness, should contact a healthcare provider. These are from Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. Election 2021. Should city elections be moved to April? By Joe Rubino, the Denver Post. Denver's clerk and recorder, Paul Lopez, identified a problem with the city's municipal elections about a year after winning his office in a runoff. Its municipal election schedules don't comply with federal and state law when a runoff is required, and it may be disenfranchising voters as a result. Referred question 2H on the November 2nd ballot asked voters to address that by moving the city's general election to the first Tuesday in April in odd-numbered years instead of the current charter-mandated first Tuesday in May. If adopted, 2H would take effect in time for the 2023 city election, when all 13 council seats and the mayor's office are up for grabs. Supporters of 2H say that with 2 months between the general election and any June runoff, the city should have adequate time to order ballots from a vendor and ship them to voters in city limits and those living overseas or deployed with the military. As outlined on the city's website, the law dictates that mail-in ballots have to be shipped to all voters 21 days before an election, 45 days for people living overseas. It's just the simplest solution to a simple problem, City Councilman Kevin Flynn said of 2H. Flynn served on a committee that reviews the city charter to find ways to bring municipal elections into compliance. Moving the spring election earlier by a month was not the only option the committee considered. It turned down the idea of pivoting to a ranked choice voting system, one in which voters number candidates in order of preference. In the city's 2021 voting guide, 2H opponents said ranked choice voting is a preferable option because it would require the city to pay for only one round of ballots and do away with the annoying runoff election that gives special interest groups more time to weigh in on races. Flynn likened pivoting to ranked choice voting to bringing a car in for a simple repair and walking out of the shop with an entirely new car. Moving the date 1 month back, he said, that provides the clerk with all the time the clerk needs to comply. Simple, easy, done. Judicial lessons of the pandemic. Your Honor, you're muted. Colorado Eyes the Future of Virtual Court by Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. To go to court in Colorado these days, you might need to drive to the courthouse, park, pass through security, belts and watches off, please, don a mask or maybe not, and put your seat in a seat. or you might just curl up on your couch, power up a laptop, and log into a video chat for a virtual court. It all depends on which judge is hearing your case and what exactly you need to get done. Colorado's initially ubiquitous use of virtual courts during the pandemic has faded into a patchwork of judge-by-judge decisions about when proceedings go forward in person or online, even as many in the justice system call for some virtual options to be preserved post-COVID-19. The mishmash of procedures across the state follows the court system's radical transformation since the pandemic began in March 2020, with the public health crisis forcing an unprecedented shift toward remote hearings and virtual appearances. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler, and we invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
A growing number of tents popping up in neighborhoods across Denver have made it harder to ignore a chronic and expanding housing crisis in Colorado and across the U.S. An initiative approved for Denver's November 2nd ballot calls for the city to crack down on campsites and to build sanctioned sites with running water, toilets, and lighting on public property. Kathy Alderman with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless says the proposal amounts to an empty promise because it fails to allocate land and other resources necessary to create safe outdoor spaces.
We know camping ban enforcements and extreme measures like the one proposed do nothing to resolve homelessness. They do not provide resources to get people into safe spaces and into housing.
Initiative 303, proposed by Garrett Flicker, chairman of the Denver Republican Party, would require written permission from owners to camp on private property, and the city would have 72 hours to respond to complaints. Denver currently is not enforcing a camping ban already on the books. A county court ruled that the law was cruel and unusual punishment in a case that could be taken up by the Colorado Supreme Court. If voters approve Initiative 303, Alderman worries enforcement will fall hardest on the city's most vulnerable residents.
Anytime you have an enforcement mechanism that is targeted at people experiencing homelessness, it is going to disproportionately impact those who are more likely to experience homelessness, which often are people of color.
Alderman points to a number of local, state, and federal proposals meant to reverse decades of disinvestment in affordable housing as a better strategy to end homelessness. She says if the city implements 303, it will actually take resources away from motel vouchers and other tools that are effective in helping people find their way into permanent housing.
So if the city is having to respond to every call about every tent, every time someone sees one, they're not going to be able to send people out to resolve issues. They're just going to be sending people out to move people around.
This is Eric Gladys reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Did you know that some snacking habits can harm your teeth? Snacks and drinks high in sugar can lead to cavities. The sugar in our food becomes acid once it mixes with bacteria found in our mouth. That acid wears away the hard covering of the tooth to create a cavity. Be aware that diet, soda, and drinks don't contain sugar, but the acid in these products erode the enamel, which leads to weakened teeth and cavities. So, what can you do to protect you and your family's teeth? Choose a variety of healthy snack options like whole grain products, milk, cheese, lean meats, fruits, and vegetables. Limit the amount of sugar in your diet and avoid snacking all day. If you have children, talk to them about the effects diet has on the body and their teeth so they can learn to make smart choices for themselves in the future. This message brought to you by DentaQuest Administrator of Health First Colorado, Medicaid, and the CHP Plus Dental Programs. For information about your DentaQuest dental benefits, finding a provider, or help scheduling an appointment, Health First Colorado members call 1-855-225-1729. Again, that phone number is 1-855-225-1729. 855-225-1729, TTY 711, and CHP Plus members call 1-888-307-6561. Again, that's 1-888-307-6561, TTY 711, or visit us at dentaquest.com/Colorado. Oh, 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 oh